uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, she was the one who knew where the bodies were buried. She was the one who did the research back when George W. Bush was running for his second term as governor of Texas into whether anybody could document, could actually clearly prove that influence was used to help him get his seat or his chair or his airplane or whatever in the Texas Air National Guard so that he could get out of service in the Vietnam War, so that he could jump ahead of several hundred other people to get into the Champagne unit where they flew airplanes that they weren't even using in Vietnam, so you had a 100% certainty you'd never end up in Vietnam. She was the one who did the investigation, paid $19,000 by the Republicans back when Bush was governor to check this thing out, to vet him, to keep that body buried. Now, she's his personal lawyer in the White House, the White House attorney, defending him, maybe, along with the criminal lawyer that he hired 2 years ago when the word of this first came up, maybe against charges of treason. George W. Bush, the President of the United States, may be charged with treason. This from George Stephanopoulos this weekend on his program on ABC TV, where he drops this little bombshell.
It's definitely a political problem, but I wonder, George Will, do you think it's a manageable one for the White House, especially if we don't know whether Fitzgerald is going to write a report or have indictments, but if he is able to show, as a source close to this told me this week, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were actually involved in some of these discussions.
Now, some of these discussions, what they're talking about here is the outing of a CIA agent and bringing down Brewster Jennings, an entire CIA front company. And the outing of Valerie Plame, who was the head, the CEO of that phony company, this outing in order to do political payback. You know, it's like the mob. You know, hey, you crossed us, buddy. We're going to get you and your wife, too. And that was it. Go after Joe Wilson and go after his wife. And the State Department pulled together a memo after Joe Wilson published his piece in the New York Times, you know, and everybody was like, who is this guy? How can we get him? State Department pulls together a memo. Here's the details on him. It gets faxed to Air Force One while Colin Powell, Ari Fleischer, and George W. Bush are flying to Africa. George W. Bush presumably gets it from Colin Powell. And, you know, soon thereafter, you've got Scooter Libby, who's Dick Cheney's number two guy, and Karl Rove, who's George Bush's number two guy, dialing for dollars, calling the media, saying, hey, you know, why don't you run a story about Valerie Plame, blah-de-blah, let's make this Joe Wilson guy sweat. How dare he think that he can take on this administration? Committing treason, bringing down an international, a multinational CIA front company that was out there saying, hey, you want to buy Stinger shoulder-fired missiles? We'll sell them to you. You don't even have to show us a driver's license. To bring the terrorists out of the woodwork. All over the world they had offices. And when Valerie Plame's name hit the newspapers, all over the world those offices not only had to close, but the local people who were the CIA agents, you know, the local employees of the CIA who were maintaining those offices, they had to go in hiding. We don't even know how many of them were murdered because this administration says that's classified information. We do know, however, that Brewster Jennings, this front company, went down. And now Stephanopoulos, I mean, catch this one more time.
As a source close to this told me this week, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were actually involved in some of these discussions.
Who on that airplane was at a pay grade where they could tell the assistant to the vice president and the assistant to the president to commit a felony? I don't think Colin Powell, number one, would have done it. And frankly, I don't think even if he would have, he could have. As Secretary of State, it was above his pay grade to speak to the assistant to the president, the assistant to the vice president, and say, I'd like you to call these newspapers and commit treason. And I for sure know that Ari Fleischer didn't have the ability to do that. I mean, he's just the press secretary. He's not even a cabinet officer. He has no power. He's the mouthpiece. So who else on that plane had the ability to take the information in that memo that was faxed to that plane when they were flying to Africa and transmit that to Karl Rove and Scooter Libby so that they could then start calling newspapers, call Bob Novak, call Judy Miller, call Matt Cooper, and start outing the CIA. Who could have done that? Who had the authority to say to the assistant to the vice to the president of the United States, Karl Rove, please do this? Who had the authority to say to the assistant to the vice president of the United States, please commit this crime? Who had that authority? George Stephanopoulos asks.
As a source close to this told me this week, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were actually involved in some of these discussions.
And now, so now, Mr. Bush says, well, you know, this might end up a trial in the Senate. Who presides over a trial in the Senate? The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What if this thing gets locked up? What if there are criminal cases that come out of this? What if there is a jurisdictional? What if there's a constitutional crisis? What if the president and the vice president are accused of treason? Certainly rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. Certainly much more than you know, a little whoopee under the desk in the White House. What if they're accused of treason and a constitutional crisis happens? And it has to go before the United States Supreme Court. Might this be a clue as to why George W. Bush would slap in the face his right-wing buddies? Here you have Michelle Malkin today saying, and I quote, what Julie Myers is to the Department of Homeland Security, Harriet Myers is to the Supreme Court. Julie Myers, by the way, you'll recall, is the niece of the General Myers, good buddy of George W., who basically got this job at Homeland Security for which she was totally unqualified. Anyhow, what Julie Myers is, this is Michelle Malkin, what Julie Myers is to the Department of Homeland Security, Harriet Myers is to the Supreme Court. It's not just that Myers has zero judicial experience, it's that she's so transparently a crony and diversity pick, while so many other vastly more qualified and impressive candidates went to waste. If this is President Bush's bright idea to buck up his sagging popularity among conservatives as well as the nation at large, one wonders whom he would have picked in rosier times. Shudder. That from Michelle Malkin. From David Frum, the National Review, William F. Buckley's old publication, the kind of standard bearer of the old Reich. The Myers nomination, David Frum writes, though, is an unforced error. Nobody would describe her as one of the outstanding lawyers in the United States. End of quote. The blog over at the American Spectator. There is now talk among some conservatives about a filibuster of the Myers nomination. Say what? The Republicans are going to filibuster Bush's nomination? Why would he do this? Why would he put forward as a nominee somebody that he should have known, certainly could have known, would so infuriate his own base? Could it be because she's his lawyer? The one cardinal characteristic of Harriet Myers throughout her career, and she has never been a judge, the one cardinal characteristic of her career is absolute loyalty to George W. Bush. Like Condoleezza Rice, a single woman, not married, no children, no other obligations. She shows up at the White House 6 o'clock in the morning, leaves at 10 o'clock at night. She's the only woman, by and large, more often than not, although sometimes Condoleezza Rice comes along too, who is invited to go to Crawford, Texas to clear brush with the guys. She follows George around like the proverbial lapdog, and she's his lawyer. Now it gets even weirder than this. Back in it, when he was governor, in the second term for governor, she was helping sanitize his records with regard to the whole question of whether or not he got a leg up, as a way. How did he get into the Texas Air National Guard? And here, quoting Newsweek's Michael Isikoff, July 17th, 2000, 5 years ago in Newsweek, quote, the Bushies' concern began, this is concern about stories coming out about his getting preferential treatment, getting into the Guard. Somebody had to die in order for George Bush to get a Guard seat. Somebody else got bumped and got drafted. The Bushies' concern began while he was running for a second term as governor. A hard-nosed Dallas lawyer named Harriet Myers was retained to investigate the issue. State records show Myers was paid $19,000 by the Bush gubernatorial campaign. She and other aides quickly identified a problem. Rumors that Bush had help from his father in getting into the National Guard back in 1968. And what they did next, and how the guy, the one guy that Harriet Myers figured out, was the guy that could have put the finger on George W. Bush and said, you're the one. The guy who could have pointed out to America that Bush got in into the National Guard using influence. How that guy ended up with $23 million in his pocket after Harriet Myers got into the act. That and more when we come right back. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman. Come together
right now over me. Well, that's the official message coming out of the Bush White House. David Frum, for example, the old speechwriter, the White House speechwriter in, I believe, the Bush senior administration, the former White House speechwriter, and you know, right-wing gadfly in general. On his blog, see, at the National Review, he's not happy about this. This is, you know, this is the conservative bunch, but he has already cleaned up his own blog. The original. Well, actually, let me give you the current version. Here's what his blog says right now. Harriet Myers is a taut, nervous, anxious personality. It's impossible for me to imagine that she can endure the anger and abuse or resist the blandishments that transformed, say, Anthony Kennedy into the judge he is today. Nor is it safe for the president's conservative supporters to defer to the president's judgment and say, well, he must know best. The record shows, I fear, that the president's judgment has always been at its worst on personnel matters. So, you know, it's a relatively weak criticism. It's not an absolute slash and burn criticism. It's relatively weak. Well, sometime between the hours, this is from Ben Wilker, who's blogging over at Air America. Yeah, thanks to Ben Wilker of Air America. According to Ben, sometime between 8:52 a.m. and 10:18 a.m. this morning, there was another paragraph in David Frum's blog, which he has now removed. Now, why would he remove it? Well, maybe he got a call from the White House. Here's what that missing paragraph said. Speaking of Harriet Myers, the nominee for the Supreme Court, says she rose to her present position by her absolute devotion to George Bush. I mentioned last week that she told me that the president was the most brilliant man she had ever met. To flatter on such a scale, a person must be either an unscrupulous dissembler, which Myers most certainly is not, or a natural follower. In other words, either she's a liar or a lapdog. And Frum says, and natural followers do not belong on the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, that is a strong statement. So, it's fascinating. The right wing is scared to death of this. And now, which raises another question. Could it be that the reason the right wing is concerned is because they want to make a great show of concern so that moderate Democrats will say, and even progressive Democrats will say, oh, gee, well, if the right wing is upset about her, we'll vote for her. I mean, you know, are we playing checkers or chess here? Are they thinking two moves ahead, three moves ahead, four moves ahead? Or is it something as banal, as simple, as the possibility that George W. Bush is facing the possibility of a criminal indictment, of a charge of treason against the United States of America, and in order to try and prevent that from happening or stack the deck to the extent that he can, just like in order to become president in the year 2000, he turned to the Supreme Court, which had several members placed there by his father's administration under the Reagan-Bush administration and under the Bush-Quayle administration, several members of that Supreme Court who voted for him for president, because we have George Bush as president in the year 2000 because of a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court, not because of the vote of the people of Florida. The people of Florida, as the New York Times, the Washington Post reported a year and a half later, the people of Florida voted in greater numbers for Al Gore than for George W. Bush. And Al Gore will come out and tell you that. In fact, I heard him speak here in Portland just a few weeks ago, and he came out and he said that. I got more votes than George W. Bush did in Florida. And in fact, when the news organizations actually counted the vote, that's what they learned. Regardless of, you know, pregnant chads, dimpled chads, hanging chads, however you find, Al Gore won the election. He won the election in Florida. He won the election nationally. Jimmy Carter came out and said this last week. So George W. Bush used the Supreme Court to get out of a failed election, to get out of having lost an election. Is he putting his lawyer, his consigliere, is he putting his lawyer on the court now? Even if it means infuriating the right-wing ideologues. Because he's trying to cover his butt legally? And if so, what does that mean for the future of democracy in the United States? I mean, this is just there's just a whole series of questions here, very large questions that have to do with this. Sources, again, in September 2003, White House spokesman, this is from the thing, Center for American Progress, White House spokesman Scott McClellan said about the CIA leak scandal, "The president has set high standards, the highest of standards for people in his administration. He's made it clear to people in his administration, and he expects them to adhere to the highest standards of conduct. If anyone in this administration was involved in it, they would no longer be in this administration." And then he added, "There's been nothing, absolutely nothing, brought to our attention to suggest any White House involvement, and that includes the vice president's office." Now, we know that the two people who committed treason were Scooter Libby, the assistant to the vice president, and Karl Rove, the assistant to the president. And yet, a year and a half ago, Bush is...
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Could it be that he was the senior administration official? Increasingly, it is looking like that might just be exactly the case.
As a source close to this told me this week, that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were actually involved in some of these discussions.
Get my lawyer on the Supreme Court right away, please. Yeah, there she goes. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
All that you touch and all that you see, all that you taste, all you feel.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. 20 years ago, I was been through many incarnations in this lifetime, and I was doing training and consulting work for a number of companies: American Express, KLM, Dutch Airlines, the government of Holland, like this, in marketing and advertising, particularly in the travel industry. And there was a guy that was working with me, Armin Lehman. We were both working through the same company, and Armin and I got to know each other. In fact, we did a series of workshops all around the United States, and some really cool ones in Europe. I remember one in Holland, in Amsterdam. And I knew that Armin was German, but I didn't know much beyond that until about 5 or 6 years ago, as I recall, his book, his memoirs first came out. It was about 5 or 6 years ago, wasn't it, Armin?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was called, what was the original edition of the book called?
The one I self-published, Hitler's Last Courier.
Hitler's Last Courier, that's right. Now, for those of you who saw the movie Downfall, about the last days of Adolf Hitler, the young teenage boy, you were what, 12, 13 at the time, Armin?
16,
okay. The 16-year-old boy who was in that movie, who was delivering the last message to Adolf Hitler in the Führer bunker in Berlin, telling him that essentially all was lost, that boy in that movie, in real life, was Armin Lehman. And Armin lives in a city that carries our program, and Armin and I have kept in touch over the years. And Armin's book is now out. It's called In Hitler's Bunker. It's been reprinted and republished by, who's your publisher now?
Oh, the writers in England, but Zion's Press in the United States.
Okay, great. And in fact, you hit the bestseller list in Czechoslovakia, didn't you?
To my great surprise.
Yeah, that's marvelous. So the book is called In Hitler's Bunker. And Armin, you are a tireless campaigner for peace and justice here in the United States, and I want to salute you for that. And you know, I don't know to what extent you want disclosed, you know, where you're living or what you're up to these days, but feel free. But what parallels do you see? I mean, you lived through the Hitler time and certainly the after the Hitler time. You were in the Hitler Youth. You knew Adolf Hitler. What parallels do you see between the Nazi phenomena in Germany and the rise of the neoconservative phenomena in the United States?
Oh, it comes down to the word spinnen, which is a German word. Now we know spin. And I was never aware how much spinning went on in the United States until I compared with what I went through during the Hitler time, which, of course, was a totalitarian regime. We had the opinion of the government and nothing else. No Tom Hartmann program, nobody who could even speak up or express an opinion of difference.
So we're not there yet. We're not even close, really, right now.
No, thank goodness we have a democracy.
Yeah. But do you see some fault lines here? Do you have some concerns?
Oh, I have many concerns. And most of them I learned through listening to your program.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah, no, okay.
I didn't know to what extent, for example, money plays a role.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just frightening.
It is. One of the things that fascinated me was the idea of homeland. In Germany, Adolf Hitler and Rudolf Hess were big students of the Zionist movement in the 20s, and they had this idea that if they could get Germans to think of themselves as a race apart, as a race separate from everybody else. And you know, the idea of Blut und Erde, blood and soil, blood and earth, that they could create a fanatic, I don't know how to describe it, but you know, just a cult, as it were. And so they started Rudolf Hess in 1930. What was it? 34. The speech in Nuremberg, the Nuremberg rallies, was that 34?
The party assembly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big one. Rudolf Hess got up and he used the word homeland for one of the first times. Usually Germany had been referred to as the Fatherland, der Vaterland. Mm-hmm. But he changed this to this word that they had borrowed from the Zionist movement, the homeland. Here's Rudolf Hess actually introducing this word, and you can tell us what he's saying after he says it.
Dank Ihrer Führung wird Deutschland sein Ziel erreichen. Heimat zu sein. Heimat zu sein für alle Deutschen der Welt. Adolf Hitler! Sieg Hitler! Sieg Hitler!
So, what did you say?
Yeah, thanks to your leadership, Germany will be homeland for the Germans. And what we at the time, or I as a child with no other exposures, didn't realize is that Hitler was half a god.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as such, you know, you went into a building and the first picture you saw was Hitler on the wall. And if you grew up in a family like I, where my father and my grandfather were pro-Hitler, you as a little boy became convinced that was the truth. My belief structure didn't collapse till 1945.
And when the war ended, what was it that caused your belief structure to collapse and for you to realize the toxicity of the Hitler cult, the Nazi cult?
Well, the captain who debriefed me was Captain Rosen, Sam Rosen, but he told me my name was Siegfried, so he had left Germany in time, and he made us see the liberation of Buchenwald and the liberation of Dachau.
So you watched, what, films of this?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Documentaries.
And that's when you realized, boy, we were really doing something awful.
I couldn't eat for 3 days, couldn't sleep for 3 days. There were some old lunchers who thought it was made in Hollywood, but I knew that this suddenly, it all fell together because Hitler at the end, how many were we? Nine, I think.
In the Führer bunker.
As part of the birthday delegation.
Mm-hmm.
In the Reich Chancellery Garden, were presented to him. How can the Reich Youth Leader give 9 boys, 9 human beings, as a gift to his Führer? Can you imagine?
Yeah. And you were one of those kids.
I was the one who remained in the bunker as a courier.
Yeah, yeah. And Hitler controlled the High Court of Germany. He merged church and state. There was a Reichsbishop, Pastor Mueller, who was the official head of the church in Germany. Some of the parallels are truly startling. Well, Armin, it's thank you for calling. It's great to hear from you. And
good talking to you, and I look for more books on the bestseller list.
Oh, that's why you originally called. I didn't realize that you had told me that my book, which one was it? Is on the Oregonian bestseller list.
It's on the Powell bestseller list.
Or Powell's. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
and that must be What Would Jefferson Do?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And may In Hitler's Bunker Do the Same. Let me just strongly encourage my listeners to read it. It's an amazing book. And Armin, you're a wonderful person, a good friend, and a tireless warrior for peace. If there's a contradiction in terms, a tireless advocate of peace. And thanks so much for calling.
I'm going to have a website, and then people can look it up and by Thanksgiving, I think.
Great. Great. Well, let us know when it happens, and
I will.
We'll bring you back and let folks know about it. Armin Lehman. Thank you, Armin.
You're welcome.
Hitler's Last Courier, the book In Hitler's Bunker. And Armin and I have had many conversations about this, and this is truly spooky stuff. And here again we have the possibility. Now, obviously, to draw parallels between George W. Bush and Adolf Hitler is pretty thin, frankly, in some regards. Adolf Hitler was a madman. And yet, the path that Germany traveled, the path that the Nazi Party traveled, at least in their early years, the path of single-party rule in a country, of saying, for example, as the Republicans are saying now to even lobbyists, that they won't even talk to a lobbyist unless that lobbyist fires all the Democrats from their staff and hires only Republicans. This gung-ho thing for single-party rule, the idea of the president nominating for the Supreme Court, his lawyer, who helped sanitize his records with regard to his service in the Air National Guard back in the 60s in the 90s as his lawyer when he was the governor of Texas, and now his lawyer who is presumably knowledgeable about what's going on with regard to an act of treason against the United States while he's in office today, appointing his lawyer even at the risk of infuriating his own right wing, is just too spooky. I mean, this is that creeping incrementalism. See, here's the thing to keep in mind, and this is the point that it's so important to make over and over and over again. The Great Depression hit the United States and Germany. And in the United States, when the Great Depression happened in the 1930s, the early 1930s, we had in the United States Franklin Roosevelt as president. And we chose a path out of it that involved the WPA and all these marvelous things. The Germans had Hitler as their leader. And we went in very different directions. We may be facing that choice again. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just because there's arsenic in the water.
It's just a little arsenic.
And just because there's mercury in the air.
Yeah, just a, you know, a little autism at Greece.
Just because the corporations run the White House.
Well, mostly.
Don't mean he don't care.
There you go, folks. Don't you know he's a compassionate conservative, and he's going to appoint compassionate conservatives to the bench, or at least people who are going to cover his butt. President Bush on Monday. This is from the Attitude blog, P-N-I-O-N line, Nion.com, out of Philadelphia. President Bush on Monday nominated White House counsel Harriet Myers, of course. Harriet Myers never served as a judge. But here's where it gets interesting. Quoting from the Attitude blog. In President Bush's National Guard scandal, in fact, Bush's Texas gubernatorial campaign in 1968, when he was starting to eye the White House, actually paid Myers $19,000 to run an internal preemptive probe of the potential scandal. This woman, for almost a decade, has been involved in helping George W. Bush cover up his past. Not long after, a since-settled lawsuit alleged that the Texas Lottery Commission, which was chaired by Myers, played a role in a multimillion-dollar cover-up of the scandal. How did this happen? Well, pretty straightforward. This, from the Washington Post, the suit involving Barnes. Now, this is Ben Barnes. Ben Barnes was, well, actually, let me quote from Newsweek first. Michael Ishikoff, July 17th, 2000. 5 years ago, Newsweek, quote, the Bushy's concern began while he was running for a second term as governor. A hard-nosed Dallas lawyer named Harriet Myers was retained to investigate the issue. State records show Myers was paid $19,000 by the Bush gubernatorial campaign. She and other aides quickly identified a problem, rumors that Bush had help from his father in getting into the National Guard back in 1968. Ben Barnes, a prominent Texas Democrat, former Speaker of the House and the Senate State Legislature, told friends he used his influence to get George W. a guard slot after receiving a request from Texas oilman Sid Adger. That's from Newsweek, 5 years ago. So what happened to Ben Barnes? Well, it turns out that Ben Barnes was the lobbyist for a company called GTEC. Harriet Myers and GTEC was involved with the Texas Lottery. There was a lottery operator. And this company was involved in a bribery scandal. Now, Harriet Myers was put in charge of the Texas Lottery Commission. And oddly, just before the bribery scandal with GTEC blew up, as Harriet Myers was beginning to look into it, Ben Barnes, who she had previously figured out was the guy that could finger George W. Bush or, you know, could get him in trouble, Barnes gets, quote, fired, end quote, by GTEC, which then gives him a $23 million severance payment. $23 million. $23 million. So you got to wonder, you know, and Barnes never came out and said anything. So, you know, Harriet Myers helped George W. cover up his problem with, you know, his little problem there in Texas. Is she now going to help him cover up his little problem in Washington, D.C.? Terry, a trucker in South Carolina. Hey, Terry, your thoughts on this? Terry? Terry, I'm sorry, you're breaking up. We're losing you. We'll go to Jeff in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Jeff, what's on your mind today?
Hey, hi, Tom. I attended the Save Our Elections conference down in Portland this weekend that you helped organize, and I, you know, just wanted to say what a great thing that was.
Well, thank you. I didn't help organize it. I was just one of the speakers. But the people who did organize it, particularly Beth Hahn, were just absolutely marvelous, and it was a great conference.
It was, and I really learned a lot. But what I really wanted to say is some talk was made about how kind of the meme or the frame that we've been using is privatizing the vote.
Mm-hmm.
And really, a better idea would to say corporatize the vote or even profiteering from the vote.
Yeah.
Because if you look at all the election machine vendors and the millions of dollars they're making from this, that's really what's going on.
Yeah, profiteering from the vote. That's a good one, Jeff. That's a really good one. I like that.
Right. Bev Harris spoke, and she really, I think you can find this on her website, Black Box Voting, but she really laid out the connections between the voting machine vendors and the state officials responsible for the procurement.
Yeah.
And it, I mean,
yeah.
It's
in fact, it's worse than cronyism, and it's all right there at blackboxvoting.org. Thanks a lot, Jeff. Terry in South Carolina, I think you're back.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we just have a half a minute. What's up, Terry?
The Florida Today newspaper, or USA Today newspaper, 5/11 of 2001, says that George Bush would have won given the recount using the most widely accepted recount method.
Yeah, I know. If you look at the USA Today, they ran that story. The New York Times and the Washington Post, however, ran the story, which was actually the accurate story, that says by any measure, George W. Bush lost in Florida. And it's very simple. He did. The USA Today was focusing on what, oddly, the New York Times and the Washington Post focused on in their first 12 paragraphs, which was that if only those counties in Florida that Al Gore had originally asked to be recounted were counted, Al Gore still would have lost. That's true. But if you recounted the entire state, as they did, as the consortium of the New York Times and the Washington Post did, Al Gore got more votes. Period. End of discussion. And you can find it on the New York Times website or the Washington Post website. USA Today just chose to go with the first part of the story. You know, if you just recounted those counties, then, you know. Sorry, Terry. Nice to know that Limbaugh sent you over here, but sorry. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you. The True People's Radio.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. And now we find that Ms. Myers was also involved in trying to get the American Bar Association, of which she was a member, to reverse its position in support of Roe v. Wade. The American Bar Association had an official position. This story is developing, as they say. American Bar Association had an official position saying, you know, abortion should be legal in the United States. Roe v. Wade is accepted law. It's now, you know, it's part of the law of the land. Stare judicis or something like that, and stare decisis, and decided law. And therefore, you know, we simply need to accept it and move on. And Harriet Myers was part of a group that was lobbying the American Bar Association to say, no, we don't believe that's the case. And, yeah, I find it fascinating that the right-wing groups are not talking about that. And if, frankly, I don't think most of the left-wing groups have gotten onto that yet. But, you know, Harriet Myers, this Myers nomination, interesting times we live in, as they say. And now you've even got, you know, the right-wing bunch going after her. And I just see these two things absolutely interrelated. Harriet Myers and, as George W. Bush's lawyer right now, as he's facing the possibility of being charged as a participant in a criminal conspiracy, not unlike Tom DeLay was just charged, only this time a criminal conspiracy to harm the national security interests of the United States and destroy a major asset of the Central Intelligence Agency, for the political partisan purpose of bringing down a political critic, specifically Joe Wilson. And Joe Wilson had this figured out early on. I mean, long, long, long time ago, Joe Wilson...
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
This was over a year ago, and Joe Wilson, he's, you know, former diplomat, ambassador, he doesn't throw around names lightly. He doesn't just come up with somebody's name.
And trust me, when I use that name, I measure my words.
Yeah. Valerie Plame's husband there, Joe Wilson, former ambassador to a whole bunch of... Actually, he was the last ambassador in Iraq working for Bush Sr. And Saddam Hussein comes out and says that he's gonna round up all the Americans and hang them. This was just before the invasion of Kuwait. Or just after the invasion of Kuwait, before the United States invaded Iraq. And so Joe Wilson organized, gets all the Americans together, gets them into the U.S. Embassy so that they're safe, starts organizing an airlift to get them out of the country. But in the meantime, to preempt Saddam Hussein, Joe Wilson goes out in front of the U.S. Embassy with a piece of rope, calls together the press, the cameras, the TV cameras, says, come on out, you know, it's a press conference. U.S. ambassador going to say something. Goes out there, puts a hangman's noose in the rope, puts it around his own neck, and says, here I am, Saddam, come and get me! In Baghdad. Backed him down. That's the guy the Bushies decided they had to get. Because he dared to tell the truth. And I just find it very interesting that Harriet Myers, George Bush's lawyer, I mean, she's got a lot of other things, I suppose, to recommend her. The fact that she was also a lawyer for Disney, which owns ABC. It'd be very interesting to see how the ABC coverage of Harriet Myers plays out. That she was also a lawyer for Microsoft, which is half owner of MSNBC. Hardball, Keith Olbermann, Joe Scarborough. Tucker, what's his name? Be interesting to see how this all plays out on MSNBC. Another corporatist lawyer. That she lobbied the ABA to not recognize abortion, legal abortion, as being decided law in the United States. And apparently Harry Reid has said, you know, she's okay with me. It seems that, you know, because she doesn't have fangs, she's not Judge Bork. She's apparently, I mean, she's never been a judge before. So she can't have some sort of bizarre ideological record because she's not a judge. She's never been a judge. You can't see her decisions. And she hasn't been arguing bizarre ideological things. She has been defending George W. Bush, hiding things in his past. She's been his lawyer since 1998, and she had a gig as a hired gun for corporations like Disney and Microsoft. So the stuff that they're going to find is not going to be sexy stuff. It's going to be, you know, what did she think about this particular case that involved Microsoft, whatever that may be. But I find it interesting that at the two thing, I got an email just, you know, minutes ago from Ken Melman, the gay president of the Republican National Committee, who, and, you know, God bless him for being gay. I got no problem with that. I think it's a fine thing. Although I do find it a little odd that he would support a party that trashes gays. In any case, Ken Melman, I got an email from him saying, Democrat groups, excuse me, Ken, it's the Democratic Party. I know you guys did your focus grouping. I know that Frank Luntz figured out that Democrat sounds more like the word rat than Democratic, kind of buries that, and therefore you want to be sure that you always refer to it as the Democrat Party, but there is no such thing as the Democrat Party. Its name, ever since Thomas Jefferson helped create it, is the Democratic party, the longest political party, the longest lasting political party in the history of the world. At least in a democracy, the Democratic Party. I believe even independent of democracies. And so anyhow, it's Ken Melman sending out this email going, yeah, these Democrat groups, they're going to bring her down. But HarrietMyers.com or JusticeMyers.com was up within minutes. I mean, George Bush makes his announcement, and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who have reinvented themselves as Progress for America, have a website up saying, oh, Justice Myers, isn't she wonderful? Isn't, you know, quack, quack, quack. All this, you know, page after page after page of very, very well done, very thought. And there have got to be right-wingers out there who are saying, why didn't he tell me? I mean, these folks had to have had enough advance notice that they could put this thing together. So what you've got is you've got a bunch of very, very upset right-wingers here. Michelle Malkin. What Julie Myers is to the Department of Homeland Security, Harriet Myers is to the Supreme Court. It's not just that Myers has zero judicial experience, it's that she's so transparently a crony. A crony! Well, yeah, hey, this is the guy who gave us the man whose career was distinguished by the fact that he busted somebody for doing liposuction on a horse. That's the guy he put in charge of FEMA. Why wouldn't he put his lawyer in charge of the Supreme Court? Or at least in charge of the, you know, on the Supreme Court, which is in charge of essentially all law in America. Just makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah, a lot of people are very concerned about this. I'm among them. This at the same time that Karl Rove and Scooter Libby. Yeah, here you got George Stephanopoulos saying that this, you know, there may be, this may be reaching to the White House. Washington Post, today's Washington Post, a new theory about Fitzgerald's aim, this is the prosecutor, has emerged in recent weeks from two lawyers who've had extensive conversations with the prosecutor while representing witnesses in the case. They surmise that Fitzgerald is considering whether he can bring charges of a criminal conspiracy perpetrated by a group of senior Bush administration officials. Presumably that would be Rove and Libby. Under this legal tactic, that was my comment, not the Washington Post. Now back to the Washington Post. Under this legal tactic, Fitzgerald would attempt to establish that at least two or more officials agree to take affirmative steps to discredit and retaliate against Wilson and leak sensitive government information about his wife to prove a criminal conspiracy. The actions need not have been criminal, but conspirators must have had a criminal purpose. So, the question, is it a criminal purpose to bring down a CIA operation and out a covert CIA operative? Is it a criminal purpose to do political payback by destroying part of the intelligence infrastructure of the United States of America for purely hack partisan purposes? We'll see what Mr. Fitzgerald thinks. 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear.
Welcome back, my friends.
If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you by Small Dog Electronics. 1-800-511-MAX. 1-800-511-MACS for all things Macintosh, all things computer. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where being progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Jerry in Rutherford, North Carolina. Hey, Jerry.
That's Tucker Carlson.
Tucker Carlson, thank you.
The smart-ass yuppie.
Yeah, there you go.
Anyway, during the Senate hearings on Ms. Myers, is it possible when the committee meets for one of them to put a hold on her nomination?
I don't know. I mean, I would believe that it's possible. I mean, will it happen?
I think there's not
a chance. I mean, you've already got Chuck Schumer has come out and said, well, she's not as bad as somebody else who is worse. It's like, what? John Kerry, I just got an email from John Kerry's office a few minutes ago, said, we want to make sure that they release all their documents that Congress asks for and that questions get answered. Well, yeah, that's what you were sputtering just before, you know, everybody voted, you know, to his credit, he voted against the nomination of John Roberts. But, you know, that's what they were sputtering about just before that. So, no, I'm expecting the Democrats to just roll over and say woof on this one.
Yeah, I am too. I was just curious about that.
Yeah. And thank you, Jerry. Good to hear from you. And the fact that you've got folks like Michelle Malkin and David Frum sputtering, going, what? She's not conservative enough. That's giving lots of smiles to some of these Democrats out here. Victoria Jones with us with the Talk Radio News Service. What are you seeing from Washington, D.C.? You've been down there at the White House today, have you not, Victoria?
I have, yes. I just attended the White House briefing where an awful lot of questions about Harriet Myers, obviously, and the issue of whether she's too conservative for not conservative enough or not known enough for conservatives has come up, was specifically asked.
Did anybody succeed in asking the question, what role did she play in covering up George W. Bush's preferential admission into the Texas Air National Guard in 1968?
No, but Helen Thomas did ask what issues she had been involved in since she came to the White House, and she tried to narrow him down on Abu Ghraib and some other issues.
Hmm. And so did you get any reasonable answers out of Scotty?
No.
I know nothing.
No, we didn't. She didn't really get anything out of Scotty at all. It's on the record, and she hammered away at it.
Yeah, good. So what's, you know, what's the buzz there? What's your sense? And you're part of the White House press corps there. What are people talking about around this thing?
Well, I mean, they're really not talking about her all that much, which I think is a sign that she may not be all that controversial unless or until something huge comes out. I mean, the big questions were, you know, what has she written? And also the big question, which, of course, Scott wouldn't answer, just kept saying there's a confirmation process for that, is what are you going to release? What are you going to release?
Yeah. Well, again, this is, I mean, in my mind, the big issue about John Roberts was that he went down to Florida on his own nickel. He was the personal lawyer for Jeb Bush and telling him how to do a constitutional end run around the Democrats to send Republican electors to Washington, D.C., even if the count showed that Al Gore got the most votes, which ultimately it did. And that then when the Republicans decided that they were going to go before the Supreme Court and argue that the count should be stopped because, as Rehnquist ruled, George W. Bush would be irreparably harmed if the count continued. I mean, that was actually the phrase in Bush v. Gore in the ruling.
Astonishing.
Yeah. That it was John Roberts who coached the lawyers, playing the role of Rehnquist, who coached the lawyers in how to argue before the Supreme Court. I mean, if this doesn't qualify somebody as incredibly partisan, I don't know what it is. And yet it was never mentioned by anybody that he was down there with John Bolton banging on the windows saying, stop the vote, stop the vote. And now you've got Myers, who played a role, apparently, in helping George Bush cover up his whole sordid Texas Air National Guard deal. And I have a horrible feeling that that's not even going to be mentioned by anybody.
If you have a good bit of documentation on that, I would be very grateful if you would send it to me.
Certainly, I will. Yeah,
that
it starts out, actually, with an article in Newsweek by Michael Isikoff in July of 2000.
I'm sure Michael Isikoff will ask them about it.
Yeah, well, let's hope so.
Yeah, exactly, you'd think.
Yeah, so what else is going on in Washington, D.C. right now?
Really, very little. I mean, there are things going on. There is the report that came out that was published in The Independent about Hurricane Katrina, which I was going to ask about today. But it really became very clear that the only issue was the Supreme Court, and in fact, I ended up asking about that. If it weren't for Harriet Myers, there would be more about how soldiers are having to buy their own body armor and how they're
this was in the Army Times. This was in the Army Times yesterday, an article about how Donald Rumsfeld that Chris Dodd had introduced legislation and actually got it passed that authorized the Pentagon to reimburse families up to $1,100 per person if they bought body armor for their own kids, and that Rumsfeld has been refusing to pay it, and Dodd saying, well, the legislation says he has the authority to pay it, he's not required to pay it, and Rumsfeld just saying, you know, blowing off the military families. They're furious.
Yes, absolutely. They are furious, as is Senator Chris Dodd.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I have a feeling that a lot of military families in America are getting it that Bush is not their friend. And in fact, I have a feeling they got it before 2004. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks a lot, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you again soon. 27 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Exposing the con and conservative, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Welcome back to our gig here, brought to you also today by Eco Wine, the organic wine company, ecowine.com, 1-888-ECOWINE. If you'd rather not have a dose of pesticides with your wine, they got some incredible stuff, and it's imported French wines, where in France, I guess to be organic, the standards are just mind-boggling. And the stuff tastes as good as any of the finest French wines I've ever had. And I've had some pretty good French wines. 1-888-ECOWINE. Welcome back to our program. 35 minutes past the hour. The theft of the 2004 presidential election comes into sharper focus as we begin looking at the 2006 election coming down the road, jockeying into position happening, and also as George W. Bush nominates to the Supreme Court one of his lawyers. You know, could that have something to do with anything at all? We'll find out. Dennis Liu wrote a piece, an op-ed piece, or not an op-ed piece, really a fairly well-researched article, that actually won one of the Project Censored Awards. It's over on the ProjectCensored.org website. The things that you would have to believe if you wanted to believe that George Bush won the 2004 presidential election. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
This is a remarkable piece that you wrote, and I'd just like to go through some of these items, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You'd have to believe that there was a big turnout, that when you have a big turnout and a highly energized and motivated electorate, that it favored the GOP. Why is that such a hard thing to believe?
Well, when there is a larger turnout in our electorate, the people who normally don't vote but are coming out for that particular election are people overwhelmingly drawn from strata that would be extremely unlikely to vote more conservative.
What about all the people that the churches cranked out?
Well, they did crank people out, but the numbers don't add up. Because if you look at, the strategy by the GOP, Karl Rove's strategy was, we're going to appeal to our base. We're going to get the conservatives and the evangelicals out to vote. Well, but then you look at the numbers. If this were true, then it would have to be the case that Bush took more of the first-time voters and lapsed voters. Lapsed voters being people who didn't vote in 2000, but did vote in 2004. And he would have to have taken more of the undecideds. But when I examine that, what you find is that among first-time voters, lapsed voters, and undecideds, they went by big margins to John Kerry. So
how is it that we had a big turnout and an energized electorate, and Bush seems to have won?
Well, that's where the vote of fraud comes into play, because it just doesn't, it's
just
not
doesn't
possible.
Add
it doesn't add up.
Okay, another thing you'd have to believe, even though first-time lapsed voters, the people who didn't vote in 2000 and undecideds went for Kerry, well, I guess that's the same thing, that
right.
Bush won 3.5.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the fact that Bush far exceeded the 85% of registered Republicans in Florida, the votes that he got out of them in 2000, receiving in 2004 more than 100% of the registered Republican votes in 47 out of 67 counties, more than 200% of the registered Republicans in 15 counties, more than 300% of registered Republicans in 4 counties, just shows how enthusiastic Florida is for George Bush.
Exactly. Now, you know, this is another part of the key part of the explanation, quote unquote, for why Bush was able to win, was that there was a large crossover vote in Florida.
The Dixiecrats.
Yes, the Dixiecrats. Now, the problem with that explanation is it doesn't hold water when you look at it closely. He actually did not increase his number of crossover votes among registered Democrats in Florida. They didn't increase over his total in 2000. And he actually lost ground by 15 points among registered independents when you compare Gore to Kerry.
Well, wait a minute. There's only three categories in Florida, aren't there, if you want to be registered? I mean, if you're going to vote Green Party or something like that, you have to register as an independent, do you not?
I believe so.
So
yeah.
if his share of the Democratic vote went down, Democratic Party registered vote went down, and if his share of the independent vote went down, how could his share of the Republican vote be more than 100% of the Republican vote?
It's not possible. Now, let me just correct one thing you just said. His share of the Democrat vote didn't change over 2000. It stayed essentially the same.
Oh, okay, so it didn't go down. It stayed the same.
Yeah.
But he got 200% of the registered Republican vote in 15 counties, 300% of the registered Republican vote in 4 counties?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing about this that's peculiar is, let's assume that this was possible, that this actually happened, which it's not possible. But let's assume for the sake of argument that he did do this. Why then do you only see this showing up in certain precincts and not in others? In many precincts, what you saw was the pattern that you would expect to see, which is that heavily Democratic registered precincts went heavily for Kerry and vice versa. But in certain precincts, you see a reversal of this pattern where there's this huge crossover vote, supposedly, from Democrats to the Republican side, except that when you look at statewide totals and you look at the exit polls of people being asked what they were after they'd voted, you find that he doesn't increase his share. In fact, he loses ground compared to 2000 among non-GOP voters.
So where did these numbers come from?
Well, that's where probably I don't know if we're going to have time to get to this, but one of my items in my list of 16 improbables and impossibles refers to Florida computer programmer Clinton Curtis.
Right. A lifelong registered Republican
mm-hmm.
who, in a sworn affidavit, said that his employers at Yang Enterprises and Tom Feeney, the Yang's general counsel, the GOP state legislator, Jeb Bush's running mate in Florida for lieutenant governor in 1994, currently congressman from Florida, then Speaker of the House in Florida,
mm-hmm.
asked him in 2000 to create a computer program to undetectably alter vote totals.
That's right. And Curtis, at the time, initially thought they were asking him to create this program as a way to try to forestall vote fraud. So that he created the program.
Got to know what it looks like if we're going to catch it.
Exactly. So then he created it. He handed it over to his employer, Mrs. Li Wan Yang, and she told him, quote, and this is in his sworn affidavit, "You don't understand. In order to get the contract, we have to hide the manipulation in the source code. This program is needed to control the vote in South Florida," unquote. So Curtis discovered this to his shock and amazement and then decided to go public eventually on this thing and filed this affidavit.
Right. Now, another thing you'd have to believe, if you believe that George Bush actually won, is that in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
that the provisional ballots, which were done by hand, and the absentee ballots, 147,400 of them,
mm-hmm.
which should be a fairly representative sample, you would think, of the total vote,
mm-hmm.
that among those, Kerry won 54.4% of the vote,
mm-hmm.
but that in the actual count itself, Kerry only got 48% of the vote and Bush got 51% of the vote.
Right.
Why does that not make sense?
No, I mean, you know, you can say that, well, maybe the provisional ballots were not identical to those people who cast votes in the election. But what makes us a little more suspicious of this particular datum is that the exit polls are consistent with what we found in the votes that were counted, the provisional ballot votes were counted and absentee ballots. They were consistent with the numbers that the exit polls were showing, that Kerry was going to carry Ohio.
Yeah. Now, I remember this night, you know, November 2nd, 2004. Mm-hmm. I was living in Vermont. I was this nationally syndicated program that you and I are on right now is carried by one of our affiliates in Vermont, WDEV,
mm-hmm.
and they had asked me to come down and do election coverage,
mm-hmm.
you know, live from the station, just locally,
mm-hmm.
and for Central Vermont, and I did. And around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, AP fed a story down, and I actually captured. I have the audio around here someplace,
mm-hmm.
In which the reporter said, "Kerry Aaron Hughes just sat George W. Bush down and told him that the exit polls all showed that he had lost the election and that John Kerry had won, and that Bush didn't seem to be concerned about that and was going to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's early to bed.
Right. And then about 20 minutes later, all of a sudden, the AP is saying Bush won.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the exit polls afterwards, you see that in the exit polls had Kerry winning from, 8 o'clock in the morning or whenever the polls opened, right up until just an hour or so before the polls closed. And then all of a sudden, in that last hour, the exit polls flipped, and suddenly everybody was voting for Bush instead of Kerry. How is that possible?
Well, it's not possible. In fact, let me, just to reinforce that, one of my items on my list here, I talk about... let me see if I can find this.
We only have about a minute left.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Well, at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, CNN is reporting, based on over 13,000 respondents, that Kerry is leading by 3 points. And then at 1:36 a.m., based on a few hundred more respondents, they show Bush leading by 2 points, a 5-point swing. So you see a 5-point swing based on a very tiny increase, a few hundred of more respondents, which is mathematically impossible.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
Something very peculiar was going on.
Something very peculiar that, and why did CNN? I've seen the screenshots. CNN mm-hmm. actually altered the exit poll information.
Right, to conform with the way that the official poll numbers were supposed.
Yeah,
to
they
be
said
coming
the voting machines are saying something different. You know, and by the way, we're supposed to believe the exit polls in the Ukraine, but not in the United States.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, very
incredible.
Same
one. Yeah. Dennis Liu, author of No Paper Trail Left Behind: The Theft of the 2004 Presidential Election. Find it over at ProjectCensored.org. Dennis, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Keep up the great work and keep spreading the good word. I appreciate
you too.
I'll do it. Okay, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
More united we stand, divided we fall. And if our backs
and welcome back, my friends.
We'll be together.
Yeah, we got to stick together. There's a Ben Franklin walking out of the Constitutional Convention in the fall of 1787. As this woman asked him, what have you produced, sir? He says, a republic, if you can keep it. And a little earlier he had said, if we don't hang together, we shall all surely hang separately. Actually, I think that was back when they were signing the Declaration of Independence. Welcome back. 50 minutes past the hour. It's about coming up 9 minutes before the hour. David Sirota points out, and brilliantly, that the Democrats just absolutely rolled over on John Roberts' greatest weakness. John Roberts' greatest weakness was the fact that he had virtually no judicial experience. He had been on the bench for a year or two, and he had virtually no judicial record, but he didn't have experience as a judge. And had they hammered at that and said, hey, wait a minute, you want to make this guy the senior-most judge in the United States, the top judge in the country, and he has no experience as a judge, or only minimal experience as a judge. Sorry, send us somebody else. Send us somebody who's been a judge, because this, after all, is not a job where you would expect or hope to have people getting on-the-job training. If the Democrats had made that point, then right now with Harriet Myers, they would be in a strong position to say, not again! Another person who has no experience as a judge? What are you doing, trying to turn the Supreme Court over to, the tricycle crowd? I mean, what's the deal here? The Supreme Court is now on-the-job training incorporated? What is this, an internship program? As David Frum, Bush's former speechwriter, pointed out, Myers, quoting David Frum, Myers rose to her present position by her absolute devotion to George Bush, end quote. Say, a woman who has essentially given her life to politics, to the law, and to George W. Bush, who had apparently, the early reports that we have, had apparently lobbied the American Bar Association to stop its position that Roe v. Wade was settled law. Was it stare decisis? And instead to say, you know, we're not going to take a position on this. And you just... She said, David Frum says, that Meyer said, quote, the president was the most brilliant man she'd ever met. Quote, end quote. So, you know, we'll see how this shakes out. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Well, Tom, this weekend I saw a story I thought you might be interested in. It's a little off topic of the judges today, but it turns out that indeed George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are suspected of being directly involved with the Valerie Plame case.
Yeah, here you go.
As a source close has told me this week that President Bush and Vice President Cheney were actually involved in some of these discussions.
That's George Stephanopoulos.
So you're punching your fists in the air saying I'm right again?
Yeah, well, see, this, you're saying this is off topic of Harriet Myers. My point in the first hour of this program, and I made it very forcibly, is that this is absolutely on topic because I think that, the you know, here you've got George Stephanopoulos on Sunday saying the president and the vice president may be indicted for criminal felony of treason, and or at least conspiracy to commit treason. And the next day, the president suggests that the next nominee to the Supreme Court should be his lawyer. Now, you know,
can they protect him if they do get, if like John Roberts, et cetera, we do get something against George? Can these people protect him?
Sure. They made him president in 2000 when he didn't win the election. Sure.
But how come he gets to go directly to the Supreme Court? He doesn't have to go to the federal court. He doesn't have to go to any other court. He gets to go directly to the Supreme Court if something goes wrong. Is that it?
Well, I don't know how it's going to play out. But anything is going to ultimately end up before the Supreme Court. And I think he's just, you know, doing some serious butt covering here. He's getting ready for the day. I mean, this is the court that made him president. Scott, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. Margaret in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Margaret.
Hi, Tom. Last week you were talking to David Sirota, and you mentioned something about contacting Congress with all this information, like about Roberts. How do we do that? Or is there an organization that can do that? Because I just emailed everyone I could think of with the information you were just talking about. But I think that packet or something have more of an impact.
Yeah, the best way to contact Congress, email is fine, but, you know, they rather easily ignore emails because they know that emails are rather easily sent when they don't require a great deal of effort. So the best way to contact Congress, your individual member of Congress and your two senators, is by the telephone or by writing them a letter. Actually, a handwritten letter has the greatest impact. Okay. Second to that is a telephone call. And the telephone number for Congress, the main switchboard, is 202, and this is regardless of where you live in the United States, 202-225-3121. And then there's a toll-free number, which you can call. They've disconnected my favorite number, the SOB USOB number. There's a toll-free number, 888-888, that's the toll-free part of it, 355-3588. 1-888-355-3588. And that will get you the Capitol Hill switchboard, and whatever state you're in, if you're not sure who your state senators are, you can simply ask. If you're not sure who your member of Congress, your representative in Congress is, give them your zip code, and they'll tell you who that person is, and they'll be able to connect you with their office. That's the best way to do it. Okay, Margaret?
Thanks.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. And get out there and make a few phone calls. With regard to Harriet Myers, you know, the story unfolds, but it looks like it's just another crony appointment. I got to tell you, in the what Andy Rooney said on 60 Minutes last night, and Dwight Eisenhower, the position that the Republican Eisenhower was taking on Sunday, we'll get into that a little later. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program. Telling the truth that the multinational corporations would really rather you didn't know about. Tom Hartman here with you. Jennifer Harbury took her law degree from Harvard University. She's lived and worked with human rights activists, peasants, and Mayan villagers in Guatemala. Harbury also worked with members of the United States Congress and the Organization of American States to locate her husband and 35 other members of the Guatemalan resistance believed to be held by the military. She's the author of Searching for Everado and Bridge of Courage and currently directs the Stop Torture Permanently campaign at the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. Her new book, Truth, Torture, and the American Way, The History and Consequences of U.S. Involvement in Torture. Jennifer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me.
Before we go any farther, is there a website where people can find out more about your book and the topics thereof?
Yes, certainly. We have a Stop Torture campaign, which covers not only the book, but our ongoing campaign to end U.S.-sponsored torture. You can read about that at the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee website, www.uusc.org, also at the Beacon Press website.
BeaconPress.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. And Beacon Press, in fact, published this book. Truth, Torture, and the American Way, Jennifer Harbury. Jennifer, reading your book, you know, parts of it are almost pornographic. The extraordinary...
cruelty.
Yeah.
And savagery. Yes,
oh, it's mind-boggling. I mean, this nun in particular, one of the more detailed stories, Sister Diana Ortiz, I believe it was.
Yes.
Who, regardless of how she answered the questions, they burned her back with cigarettes, over 111 cigarette burns, the gang
on her back alone.
Yeah. And then, you know, we find out that there was an American involved in this stuff. The tortures in Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras that you document so well in this book. The thing that concerns me the most is not the, let's lay out what's going on and how bad it is and, you know, aren't we bad sort of storyline that I think a lot of folks will latch onto when they read the book, but rather the fact that this is harming America. It's harming American interests, and it's harming our ability to get decent intelligence. Can you speak to that issue for a moment?
Absolutely. The myth that we're given again and again is that since September 11th, we have to allow torture to somehow become legal or at least accepted and that we should look the other way while it's going on because it's the only way to stay safe. It's the only way to get good intelligence. And in fact, what the use of torture does is hideously endanger, first of all, our own troops, our servicemen and women that we are supposed to be supporting.
How so?
Well, I mean, for one thing, if we're declaring things like waterboarding, the use of rats or cigarette burns to be somehow legal for us to do to detainees, then it is legal to do to our troops. We've thrown away the protections of the Geneva Conventions. It's a two-way street, very much. Now,
folks, if we can just dwell, I'd just like to take, because these are like big memes in our culture. They're big stories. And you talk to the average, you know, guy at a truck stop or the average person in a 7-Eleven or whatever, and you know, say, you know, did you know we're torturing? And they're like, yeah, you got to get them bastards. I think it's really important for people to get it why this is such a destructive thing. And get it, you know, top to bottom, viscerally.
Well, why don't I go through it point by point then in terms of U.S. security and also security of our troops? Because I think if I go through it point by point, it makes the most sense with
Fine.
A coherent answer.
Sure.
Number one, if you talk to any of our intelligence experts in U.S. intelligence branches and services or in the Mossad or any other group that is really good at getting intelligence, they will tell you the same thing, which is torturing somebody does not get you good intelligence. It gets you Niagara Falls in most cases, and that the person is so desperate for you to stop hurting him or her that they will say anything at all that they think you want, such as Diana Ortiz saying, yes, that's me in the photo, no, that's not me in the photo. There's a classic example of a detainee at Abu Ghraib who admitted that he was Osama bin Laden in disguise, which was ridiculous. He said it because he was being hurt. Most people will say anything under torture. There are some people who are extremely well-trained, who are well-trained to say false information for the first 48 hours while their colleagues move everything and change everything around, change all of the locations, the safe houses, the codes, et cetera, et cetera. And by then it's too late, of course. But one way, and then there's a third category of people that are convinced they're going to die anyway, so they say nothing at all because they don't want innocent people to be harmed. What you don't get is a good, precise answer of the bomb is located over there, and then you go out and rescue the people in that area. Anyone that was in Vietnam, for example, can tell you that. People who were, in fact, in the interrogation teams admit that that didn't save any lives in the long run. Much more importantly, though, if you look at all of the historical examples, including current examples like in Israel-Palestine, when there is a use of excessive force, shock and awe, terror, very strict restrictive measures that make people lives miserable, torture of family members, et cetera, and humiliation of family members and degradation, what happens is that there may be a lull in the attacks for a little while because people are terrorized, but then they are so outraged that they all band together and drive out the occupying force. France and Algeria, for example, certainly Gaza has not gotten quieter. Northern Ireland does not get any quieter by the day. Mandela did end up president of South Africa. Things in Vietnam went very haywire, needless to say. If we torture these people, we're going to make all the rest of the people in the Islamic world so outraged and so infuriated with the United States that there are going to be many, many more bombing attacks against our own troops. For example, the not only is it not nice, it's stupid.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, well said. And so, in finally, in this last minute we have, what can people do to get involved with this?
There are many human rights organizations working on these issues. We have constant urgent actions and updates on legislative bills. A number of senators and congressmen are working very hard on these issues. The key is to get organized and work in concert and in an organized way with everybody else. You don't want to just stand up on one issue and speak by yourself. Certainly you can get a lot of information on our website. Again, that's www.UUSC, Unitarian Universalist Service Committee.org. Look for the bright red stop sign with the Abu Ghraib figure in the middle. You can certainly contact Amnesty International, Human Rights First. We're all working together on this.
Great. Thank you so much. Jennifer Harbury, the title of the book, Truth, Torture, and the American Way, the History and Consequences of U.S. Involvement in Torture. A brilliant piece of work. Some very difficult work, no doubt. This had to be a tough book to write. It was a tough book to read. Truth, Torture, and the American Way, Jennifer Harbury. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
In the good old USA, I'm proud to say, we got brand new action, good old fashioned too. And the future so bright, like stars in the night. Just smiling down on everything we do.
And welcome back to the radio support group of I for We the People. Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. Bill Bennett.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do. But your crime rate would go down.
Well, let's see now. African Americans in this country represent a not insubstantial portion of the population. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but my recollection is around 13 to 18%, something like that. Fewer than 1% of the CEOs of major corporations in this country certainly are African American. So I think that we could say that white-collar crime would not be impacted by that. According to an FBI report cited by the Center for Corporate Policy, if you were to look at all the blue-collar crime, now this is black and white together, and every other, you know, whatever other colors you want to toss in there. If you combine the cost of all the robberies in the United States in 2001, last year that we have an FBI report for, plus all the break-ins, all the burglaries, all the larceny thefts, the total of the value of all stolen cars, all of the property crimes in this country, the total, $17 billion. Okay. Now, you know, the majority of those crimes were committed by whites. But, you know, just set that aside for a minute. Still, $17 billion, all property crimes. One Republican, George W. Bush's largest lifetime donor, best friend, Kenny Boy Lay, cost Americans about $40 billion that same year. Does that mean, then, that if you want to stop crime in the, or reduce crime in the United States, you should be aborting Republican babies? Republicans fight to prevent all Americans from being fully covered by a national Medicare system, even though 80% of Americans would like that. While last year, their white-collar cronies looted an estimated $100 billion, that's the GAO estimate, to $400 billion, that's Malcolm Sparrow at the Kennedy School of Government's estimate, from our patchwork privatized corporate system of health care. Bill Frist's father became a multi-billionaire from our Republican health care system. Frist made millions selling his stock in Daddy's company recently. All that money originated with us. The Association of Certified Fraud Examiners estimates that of the many forms of white-collar crime, just the single category of fraud alone racks up over $600 billion a year for its criminal perpetrators. White Republicans, in large part. While about 16,000 people in the United States every year are murdered, again, you know, the majority white, murdered by whites. Nonetheless, CCP studies show, as the Center for Corporate Policy show, that over 70,000 Americans are killed directly or indirectly by products sold them in this country by large corporations. Another 5,000 die on the job. Additional tens of thousands die every year from corporate pollution, defective products, tainted food, addictive substances such as tobacco. 500,000 of us will die from cancer this year. The average citizen in this nation, carries over 100 cancer-causing chemicals. Most of those chemicals created by large, white-owned, Republican-leaning industrial concerns. So, if you want to control crime in the United States, if you really want to reduce the financial impact, if you want to reduce the number of deaths as the result of crime in the United States, abort Republican babies. Well, the Bennett, the racist bloviators would say, what about the fact that you've got all these, you know, disproportionately large number of black people are in jail? Well, about two-thirds of federal prisoners are thrown into jail for drug crimes. And as the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights points out, while African Americans today constitute only 14% of all drug users nationwide, they are 35% of all drug arrests, 55% of all drug convictions, and 75% of all prison admissions for drug offenses. Bill Bennett, and then Bennett comes out and he says, well, I was just quoting the Freakonomics people in this article in Salon or Slate. I think it was Salon.com. In fact, that's not what they weren't talking about race. They said that as in those areas where abortion is decriminalized and is available, you have lower crime. Why? Because they associated crime with unwantedness. That unwanted children become unwanted adolescents, become unwanted adults, become criminals. They're more likely to. And when abortion is legal, you have fewer unwanted pregnancies. It's got nothing to do with race. In fact, they say it has nothing to do with race, but Bennett comes out and says, well, I was just quoting those guys. Sorry, not the case. Got nothing to do with race. Got nothing to do with political party either. I mean, you know, when I say, abort the Republican baby, I'm speaking facetiously. In fact, my parents are Republicans, so it would be a terrible thing. But you get the point. I mean, you know, Bennett trying to cover his butt, and the real statistics just don't bear it out at all. I'm sorry. Just don't bear it out at all. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It was in the early morning hours.
when I fell into a phone call.
And welcome back.
Believing I had supernatural powers, I slammed into a brick wall.
You must be named George W. Bush. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number. Last night on 60 Minutes on CBS, a rare moment of startling candor. Andy Rooney.
I'm not really clear about how much $1 billion is, but the United States, our United States, is spending $5.6 billion a month fighting this war in Iraq that we never should have gotten into.
Never should have gotten into? Andy Rooney said that, and I'm sitting there going, what? Did I just hear him say that on national network television?
We still have 139,000 soldiers in Iraq today. Almost 2,000 Americans have died there. For what? Now we have the hurricanes to pay for. One way our government pays for a lot of things is by borrowing from countries like China.
Yeah, and then he goes on with this stuff. And then he points out a little story about Eisenhower.
We're spending $200 million a year on bullets alone. It's a lot of target practice. We have 1,155,000 enlisted men and women and 225,000 officers. One officer to tell every 5 enlisted soldier what to do. We have 40,000 colonels alone and 870 generals. We had a great commander in World War II, Dwight Eisenhower. He became president, and on leaving the White House in 1961, he said this.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
Well, Ike was right. That's just what's happened.
That's Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes. God bless him. You know, well done, Andy. Now, this is the thing that most people don't remember, is that this Republicans in Eisenhower's day used to be in favor of something called peace. In fact, here's a campaign commercial from Eisenhower's 1962 campaign for president.
Eisenhower knows how to deal with the Russians. He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower. Now, a paid film.
Now, you've got a bunch of Democrats out there who are scared to death to come out and say, you know, we're in favor of peace. They think it's going to be like McGovern. You know, what they don't realize is that Ed Muskie, who was also an anti-war candidate back in the Nixon days, could have easily beat Richard Nixon. It's why Nixon sent Charlie Colson and company, the Dirty Tricks Bunch, off to New Hampshire to forge the Canuck letter. And some argue put drugs in Muskie's coffee so that he gets up in the back of that flatbed truck and starts blubbering about his wife. It ended his campaign. Because of the Republican dirty tricks. Why? They wanted to take Muskie out. They knew that Muskie could defeat Nixon. They knew Nixon could trounce McGovern. It had nothing to do with his political positions. It had to do with, you know, how he was perceived as a leader, his charisma, his gravitas. Even though McGovern was a decorated war hero in World War II, somehow that never got through. McGovern came across as a little too academic, a little too sissy, as it were. That's the word the Republicans were using back then to describe him. But what the Democrats today, they're terrified of, you know, John Kerry doesn't want to be another George McGovern. And he's got to be a man's man. He's got to go out there and kill us geese. Remember that gratuitous duck goose hunting? Come on, John. Dwight Eisenhower, the Republican, running for president.
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. Elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
I mean, just
a paid film.
Just so straightforward. There's just nothing about it. And here's Dwight Eisenhower speaking before the Republican National Convention in 1964, the convention that nominated Barry Goldwater, the former president of the United States, Republican Dwight Eisenhower.
There is only one real peace now, and that is peace for all time. Now, there are three imperatives of peace. three requirements that the prudent man must face with unblinking realism.
And when he talked about unblinking realism, Dwight Eisenhower, I mean, he understood it. He got it. This is a guy who had been the commander of American forces taking out Hitler in World War II. He knew the horrors of war. And therefore, he had become a man of peace.
The first imperative is the elementary necessity of maintaining our own national strength, moral, economic, and military.
Notice that he identifies our national strength as not just being an overbloated $400-500 billion a year military. He said we must have moral strength. We must have economic strength. Now, since that time, Republicans have come along and sold us down the tubes. Ronald Reagan running us into the first $1 trillion deficit. Eisenhower's rolling over in his grave. He continues.
It is still my conviction, as I wrote in 1947, the compelling necessities of the moment leave us no alternative to the maintenance of real and respectable strength, not only in our moral rectitude and our economic power, but in terms of adequate military preparedness. Our economic power, as everyone knows, is displaying a capacity for growth which is both rapid and sound, even while supporting record military budgets. We must keep it growing. But moral strength is also essential. Today, we are competing for men's hearts and minds and trust all over the world.
Well, we were. Till we started bombing them. Till we started saying they were evil empires.
In such a competition, what we are at home and what we do at home is even more important than what we say abroad.
Yeah, and at home, we're operating a concentration camp down off the coast of Cuba, where we've put people who have no access to trial. We're locking up our American citizens, Jose Padilla, and saying, sorry, you can't even talk to a lawyer. You have no right to a trial. And all over the world, they're looking at us going, oh, this is how we should be?
Here again, my friends, we find constructive work for each of us. What each of us does, how each of us acts, has an influence on this question. Now, the second imperative of peace is collective security. We live in a shrunken world, a world in which oceans are crossed in hours, a world in which a single-minded despotism menaces the scattered freedoms of scores of struggling independent nations. To ensure the combined strength of friendly nations is for all of us an elementary matter of self-preservation.
Unless you talk to John Bolton. John Bolton says, no, sorry, our collective strength, nah, don't think so, not important. Here's Dwight Eisenhower as he was leaving office in 1961.
Our military organization today bears little relation to that known of any of my predecessors in peacetime, or indeed by the fighting men of World War II or Korea.
So he's pointing out that when Roosevelt took us into World War II, we didn't have a tank industry. We didn't have a military aircraft industry. He had to say to General Motors, you're going to stop making cars and start making tanks.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry.
None.
American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense.
Now, this is where Eisenhower, the Republican, this is where Eisenhower says, you know, we've got to have a military, but, and wait for the but.
Been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development. Yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil,
resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society.
And then he points out there's a danger to this military industry we've created.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
This is Dwight Eisenhower. This is the Republican president of the United States leaving office. As he's leaving office in January, the first week of January of 1961, John Kennedy coming in, and Dwight Eisenhower, his farewell message to America, saying, "Be careful. Be careful, my friends. There is a danger. We have created something that this country has never before seen, this military-industrial complex. And even its spiritual impact," says the Republican president. Be careful. Oh, how far the Republican Party has fallen. How badly they've sunk. How disastrously they've turned their backs on us, on America, on the world, on the hopes and ideals and dreams of the world that were embodied once by this country. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the light surrounding you.
Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dwight Eisenhower, today's Republicans, you got Dick Cheney saying, Reagan taught us that deficits don't matter. Ronald Reagan ran up a $1 trillion debt. People say, oh, we had a great economy during Ronald Reagan's time. Things look pretty good. Well, I'll tell you, you give me a credit card with a $1 trillion line of credit on it, I can cause it to look pretty good, too. This year, though, we're going to spend $160 billion. $160 billion just in interest on the debt that Ronald Reagan ran up. We and our children are going to be paying off Ronald Reagan's debt for a long, long time. And now George Bush has taken that from $1 trillion up to $7 trillion. We're pushing $8 trillion. What would a real Republican say about that? What would Dwight Eisenhower say about that?
As we peer into society's future, you and I and our government must avoid the impulse to live only for today, plundering for our own ease and convenience the precious resources of tomorrow. We cannot mortgage the material assets of our grandchildren without risking the loss also of their political and spiritual heritage. We want democracy to survive for all generations to come, not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow.
Not to become the insolvent phantom of tomorrow. Do you get just how far? I mean, just even on the Republican side, you know, Eisenhower was one of those, you know, guys who didn't think we should have, you know, didn't think unions were all that great and didn't, you know, wasn't in favor of minimum wage. I mean, you know, he had a lot going wrong, right? But still, you know, the Republicans, at some level, there was still this sense of, you know, we're a moral nation. We do things right. We may have legitimate political differences about how to accomplish things, but we do things. We don't plunder the future. And the Bushies, hey, give another billion to Halliburton. So they lost $8 billion in Iraq. We can't figure out where it went. Not just Halliburton, a whole bunch of them. So Paul Bremer lost a couple hundred million. It doesn't matter. Just send them some more cash. Incredible. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, Gary in Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to share, if I may. I just happened to hear your last half an hour. It was another coincidence. It dovetails. I think you're so right. Even Dwight Eisenhower had some had a standard that we need. I think he was even kind of statesmanship-like, and that's what we need. There's a huge difference between a statesman and a politician. And I just like to quote Ed Muskie's terrific philosophy, Greek philosophy that he articulated in 1968 on his vice presidential nomination. And in it, are you there?
Yeah.
Sure. And in it he said this, if I may, I'd appreciate it.
If it's very quick.
We are capable in democracy at taking risks and evaluating them beforehand. Others are brave out of ignorance. When they stop to think, they begin to fear.
Yeah.
But the man who must truly be counted is he who best knows the meaning of what is sweet in life and what is terrible.
Yeah, and it's well said, Gary, and thank you very much. I'm sorry. I just, I don't let people read on the air. Here's Dwight Eisenhower.
During the long lane of the history of...
I wanted to set this up. I wanted to go out with this thing. Dwight Eisenhower talking about fear, talking about how a president should never use fear, an administration should never use fear. That fear is not the bludgeon that you want to hit the American people with.
During the long lane of the history yet to be written, America knows that this world of ours, ever growing smaller, must avoid becoming a community of dreadful fear and hate, and be instead a proud confederation of mutual trust and respect. Together we must learn how to compose differences, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose.
With intellect, not with arms, but with intellect and decent purpose. I mean, can you imagine? Here's Eisenhower again.
May we be ever unswerving in devotion to principle, confident but humble with power, diligent in pursuit of the nation's great goals. To all the peoples of the world, I once more give expression to America's prayerful and continuing aspiration.
Our prayer.
We pray that peoples of all faiths, all races, all nations may have their great human needs satisfied, that those now denied opportunity shall come to enjoy it to the full, that all who yearn for freedom may experience its spiritual blessings. Those who have freedom will understand also its heavy responsibility, that all who are insensitive to the needs of others will learn charity, and that the scourges of poverty, disease, and ignorance will be made disappear from the earth.
Now, this was our prayer as articulated by a Republican president.
And that in the goodness of time, all peoples will come to live together in a peace guaranteed by the binding force of mutual respect and love.
And love a Republican. And you've got Democrats who are afraid to say we are in favor of peace because they're afraid to look like wimps because they think that the Republicans are going to out-macho them. And yet this, it's just mind-boggling. You know, Kerry's got to go out there and shoot up some geese. Nobody's willing to stand up. None of the Democrats are willing to stand there with Cindy Sheehan in Washington, D.C.
Well, we don't want to talk about peace. The real men don't talk about peace.
They're turning their back. They're turning their backs on the history of this country. On the ideals of this country. Even ideals that were shared by Republicans. I mean, the Democrats were saying the same thing. Kennedy was talking about peace, too. In fact, some of his most eloquent speeches were about peace. Time for us to wake up America, my friends. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.